The big National Defense Authorization Bill, it's moving through Congress. It passed the House yesterday, and the Senate is expected to take it up next week. In purely military spending terms, the bill is a mixed bag. Some programs and platforms get plus-ups, others get cuts. Todd Harrison is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He's been studying the bill, and he joins me now. Todd, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so at the if you look at the base budget discretionary, it's under $500 billion, $495.5 to be precise. That's pretty slim by historical standards, right?
That is. For recent historical standards, that takes us back to about the level of base defense spending we were at in 2007 when you adjust for inflation. And that is, that level, it's no coincidence, they were trying to be compliant with the Budget Control Act, the budget caps that are in effect for 2015 that apply to the base budget. So they do appear to have met that level. Now, keep in mind that this is an authorization bill. It doesn't actually set funding levels. You still need an appropriations bill to do that. But the authorization bill implies a certain funding level that would be required, and at least at that level, they are meeting the Budget Control Act for the first year for 2015.
So appropriators could go a little lower, but they can't go higher, correct?
Well, they could go lower. That's unlikely to happen. They could go higher, but going higher would be silly because it would trigger a sequester. And the sequester is the automatic budget reduction that happens when you exceed the budget cap, where every applicable account gets cut by a uniform percentage. No one wants that. And in 2015, you know, the budget caps have been adjusted to a slightly higher level than they originally were. That was part of the Ryan Murray bipartisan budget agreement from about this time last year. So it appears that, you know, both sides, they don't want to reopen that debate for 2015 and try to renegotiate it. So they're going to stick to that budget cap level.
So you might say the Budget Control Act did its work with respect to, you know, ceiling on all of this.
It did. And, you know, part of the reason it did its work is we had this bipartisan budget agreement a year ago where both parties sat down and they did renegotiate the level of those caps. The caps originally were about $5 billion lower than they are today, but they renegotiated it and both sides bought into it that they would stick to that level at least for 2015. And so far they have.
And if you look at the summary that was put out by Chairman McKeon of the House Armed Services Committee, you know, he's got one column on the left, all of the savings achieved cuts, and some of those are approaching $500 million, more than, well, actually one's more, $1.5 billion. And on the right is all the things they added to. When you kind of synthesize all of the cuts and all of the adds to programs, specific platforms and programs, who are the winners here?
You know, of course, it's a mixed bag, but I think that, you know, a lot of the cuts are coming from things where, you know, the congressional overseers were able to, you know, take information that's more recent than DOD had when they were putting the budget request together and look for programs where perhaps DOD wasn't going to be able to execute on it anyway and go ahead and take a little money there, or there were, you know, some unobligated funds from prior years, or just giving DOD different direction, not allowing them to do something they had planned to do. If you look at the winners, you know, not to be too flip about it, but I think the winner in many cases is the status quo that Congress was trying to prevent DOD from making a number of changes. You know, for example, the Air Force was trying to retire their legacy A-10 fleet, and Congress is preventing that retirement. They are allowing the Air Force to study it more, to perhaps reduce the readiness, put some of these planes in a backup status in the interim. But they did prevent the wholesale retirement that the Air Force was pursuing. The Navy was looking to put a number of cruisers into layup, and you know, that's basically shrink wrapping them so that, you know, you can preserve them and bring them back in the future if you need them. Congress, I think, instead of allowing the Navy to do 11 of those, they're only allowing them to do 2 of them. So, you know, again, they're preserving the status quo, keeping things as they are today. So, you know, there are a number of examples, I think, where when Congress is adding things back, the winners, if you will, they're trying to protect things that already exist.
Now, in the case of the A-10, that's, of course, been talked about a lot, and they plussed that up by $333 million. The Air Force has been saying that if we do that, then we don't have the resources we need to train people for some of the newer, specifically the F-35 coming out. And so there's, in one sense, even when they get more for something, there's a cost to other programs that they might, in the military, have a higher priority than Congress does.
Well, exactly. And, you know, that's part of the issue here is in a budget-capped environment, anything you add has to be offset somehow. And so, yeah, there are going to be consequences to anything that Congress puts back that wasn't in DOD's request. Now, I think the Air Force, it might come back to bite them that they used the F-35 argument in the A-10 debate. You know, basically they're saying that we had planned to move some of the maintainers from A-10 squadrons to train them to become F-35 maintainers. And if we can't retire the A-10, then we won't have enough maintainers when our first squadrons of F-35s become available. Well, if that's really true and they're being forced to keep the A-10s, then you scratch your head for just a second and say, oh, so you're not going to be able to actually operate and maintain your first couple of squadrons of F-35s? Well, I might as well go slow down the procurement funding for the F-35 then. I don't think that's what the Air Force wants, but that may be the next move in this chess game with Congress.
And of course, you know, just not to get too deeply into that particular issue, but maintaining an F-35 is probably a totally different animal than maintaining the 40-year-old A-10. They're not even made of the same materials.
Absolutely. And it's probably going to require many more maintainers per aircraft to maintain the F-35, at least originally when we're trying to get to IOC. And, you know, you do have to put people through, as you said, it's a different aircraft, different systems, different technologies. You're going to have to put people through a very different school. So, you're going to be pulling people out of some job somewhere. Now, in all of the Air Force and over 100,000 people they have in the force, I would think they could identify, another 1,000, or I think they need like 2,000 people to train to be F-35 maintainers. You would think they might be able to find those people elsewhere. I could give them a list of names in the Pentagon. They could be reassigned.
All right, well, they're probably standing by for that right now. I mean, you know, these kinds of debates go back, well, forever. But, I mean, the current things that are floating around in this budget go back to at least Bob Gates when he was secretary. So it seems as if the industry and the services and Congress and the secretaries of defense all have agendas, none of which ever really get affected in full. Is that a good way to look at it?
Yeah, it is. And because, you know, that's because DOD doesn't get to set its own budget. Congress sets its budget. So you've got a board of directors of, you know, 535 individuals, and they have different views about what DOD should be doing. That's the way our system is supposed to work. This is Congress's job, is to control the purse strings and to provide the oversight of what the military is doing. Sometimes it seems like we have too many cooks in the kitchen, but sometimes that oversight can be very useful and effective.
We're speaking with Todd Harrison, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And so I wanted to ask you also about facilities, because there was a tussle between whether there should be a BRAC or not, and this bill prohibits reduction in a wholesale kind of way of facilities. In fact, there's $666 million added for depot maintenance. So what's going on with respect to bases and depots and upgrades in the infrastructure?
Well, this is, you know, an ongoing political fight. For a number of years, in each budget request, DOD has been requesting another round of base closures. From a DOD perspective, they look at their inventory of bases and facilities within the United States, and that's what they need permission to start closing. And they've got excess capacity. Estimates are of around 20%. Now, you know, what business in the world would continue operating with 20% of its factories or stores that weren't being utilized? DOD can't close those facilities without approval from Congress. They've They've been trying to get that approval. Congress has not been willing to provide it. Of course, you know, the obvious reason is if you're closing a base, it's in someone's district, and someone's, you know, is going to be losing jobs in their district. So members are worried about that. But also, members of Congress, you know, point to DOD and say, hey, you told us something similar a decade ago when we had the 2005 BRAC, and look what happened. You know, that BRAC cost a lot more than originally estimated. In fact, it cost more than all previous rounds of base closure combined. It did not save as much as you predicted. We're just getting close to the break-even point on that BRAC. And you didn't reduce the size of your footprint very much at all. By my estimates, I think we actually only closed about 3% of DOD's facilities during that last BRAC. You know, so what gives? And you know, I think they're rightly concerned that this BRAC might end up being like the 2005 BRAC. Of course, the 2005 BRAC was different because it was at a time when the department wasn't shrinking. We were actually growing, and we were at war. And that BRAC actually was not many closures. It was a lot of realignments, a lot of movements, which are very expensive. And the way it was conducted, it seemed to kind of get out of hand in some cases. You know, I think what DOD is legitimately trying to do this time is something that is needed, you know, but it's going to take some time to build that trust in Congress. And politically, it is going to be an uphill battle the whole way trying to get another round of base closures.
And if you take as the postulate that the Overseas Contingency Operations Fund is for, you know, what it says, things going on now, Iraq and Afghanistan, the fight against ISIL, and there's a lot of things that they're funding that the administration had requested. Getting back to the base budget then, when you look at this and having looked at budgets for many years, does this base budget reflect what the military and I guess political leaders think should be happening in the long run?
Not so much. You know, you look at what their, you know, long-term defense planning, looking at, you know, what's the future of warfare going to be in 10, 20, 30 years? What are the types of capabilities we're going to need to operate effectively in that time? They're starting to make some investments in those long-term capabilities, but it's not, you know, we're trying to pivot from, you know, the previous decade of, you know, large, protracted, messy ground wars, counterinsurgency type operations, to some future operating environment that is still somewhat uncertain. And that transition is slow, and I think it's being made even slower by the budget caps that we've got in place. It's difficult for DOD to start transitioning to a new set of capabilities and a new way of doing business in the future. And, you know, that transition is only slowed down even more when DOD is denied the opportunity to do things that would save it money in the long run and help it fund that future readiness. And so here I'm talking about things like compensation reform. And again, you know, in the NDAA, Congress did give DOD some relief on compensation. They gave them some of the changes they requested, but they again rejected large parts of it, such as the wholesale restructuring of the TRICARE program. And so that has a very long-term consequence for DOD, that those savings, you know, if Congress continues to reject them year after year, the large savings that, you know, those changes could bring are not going to materialize in the future. And that means that we won't be able to afford some of those future capabilities, or it will take longer, or we will have to make deeper cuts in force structure.
Let me ask you a couple of detail questions. There's language in there about the Office of Net Assessment and restructuring that. What is it, and what's the significance of that particular move in this bill?
You know, I'll be perfectly honest, I haven't read the language in there about the Office of Net Assessment, but, you know, what that office is, it's a relatively small office within the Pentagon that has existed since the 1970s. The head of the office, Andrew Marshall, has been there since the inception, and he's actually retiring this year.
So he may know the place better than Ashton Carter.
He knows the place better than probably anyone. And he's served, you know, all the secretaries of defense in the interim. But you know, that office was created basically to be a long-term future thinking office that could provide some independent advice directly to the Secretary of Defense. And it has been reporting directly to the Secretary of Defense until just recently. It was reorganized, and in the org chart, it now falls under the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, but it's supposed to still have a direct line of communication with the SecDef.
Well, I think what this bill does is move it back to the way it was.
That's part of the battle that's been going on here is, you know, recently the leadership within the Pentagon has been wanting to move it under OSD policy. And there have even been proposals in the past to eliminate the office. But, you know, it's got a fair amount of support in Congress. And so Congress has been basically pushing back and saying, no, we want you to keep the office as it is. We want you to preserve the funding for it. So there is that tug of war that's going on between Pentagon leadership and the Congress over this office.
Well, it looks like Congress may prevail then, I guess, if this sails through the Senate, or at least gets through the Senate. And the other question I had was about the Quadrennial Defense Review. That's something that Buck McKeon, by name, is saying in this bill as being dissatisfied, or at least in the summary that he's dissatisfied. What do you think might happen there?
You know, talking to folks on the Hill, I think there's kind of a universal dissatisfaction with the QDR, and it's not so much unique to this QDR. It's what it has become is not what the authors of that legislation originally intended. They really wanted a long-term strategy look, and it has turned into more of a budget justification, quite frankly. And, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are starting to think about how do we change this? How do we change the requirements? Do we eliminate it? If it's not serving the purpose that Congress intended, it is costing a lot of resources for DOD to do a QDR. You have, QDR offices set up in the services in OSD and all sorts of, supporting personnel scattered throughout the bureaucracy. And it has become almost a continuous thing. It never really stands down. People are always thinking about the next QDR and what to do. I'll tell you that, in my view, I think the National Defense Panel, which is an independent panel Congress has set up in the last several QDR cycles, to review the QDR and provide an independent perspective, an outside perspective to Congress. I think that actually serves a very useful purpose. I would elevate that. If I was king for a day, and I would say that's going to be my strategy review, and it's going to be conducted outside of the Pentagon with people appointed by Congress, and it'll report directly to Congress, and I would then leave it to DOD.
Sure.
If you want to do a strategy review or not to counter what this independent panel is telling me, go for it. If you don't, I'm just going to rely on what this independent panel is telling me.
Well, maybe they're listening, and thus the Republic will get through one more year, I guess. Todd Harrison is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.